Liz is going to come and read Luke chapter 9, verses 37 to 50 to us.
If you've got a church Bible, it's on page 1040. Luke chapter 9, and we're starting to read at verse 37 through to 50. The next day, when they came down from the mountain, a large crowd met him. A man in the crowd called out, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only child." A spirit seizes him, and he suddenly screams. It throws him into convulsions so that he foams at the mouth. It scarcely ever leaves him and is destroying him. "I begged your disciples to drive it out, but they could not." "Oh, unbelieving and perverse generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you and put up with you? Bring your son here." Even while the boy was coming, the demon threw him to the ground in a convulsion. But Jesus rebuked the evil spirit, healed the boy, and gave him back to his father. And they were all amazed at the greatness of God. While everyone was marveling at all that Jesus did, he said to his disciples, "Listen carefully to what I'm about to tell you. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men." But they didn't understand what this meant. It was hidden from them so that they did not grasp it, and they were afraid to ask him about it. An argument started among the disciples as to which of them would be the greatest. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, took a little child and made him stand beside him. Then he said to them, "Whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me. For he who is least among you all, he is the greatest." "Master," said John, "we saw a man driving out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he is not one of us." "Do not stop him," Jesus said, "for whoever is not against you is for you."
Let's have our Bibles open at that passage. We're going to look at it now. Well, in every Marvel's comic movie, there comes a moment where the main character comes crashing down to a low point, and then, amazingly, they learn something that eventually leads to the defeat of the villain. It happens every, it's like clockwork. It's almost a well-worn formula by now. In the latest Marvel's film, Doctor Strange, there comes a point where the baddie gets really powerful, not new, and things start looking big, not new, and good in the world seems to be completely defeated. And Doctor Strange's tutor turns to the doctor and says, "I only saw your possibilities in your future. You have such a capacity for goodness. You always excelled, but only because of your arrogance and fear. You always excelled, but only because of your arrogance and fear. And yet your arrogance and fear kept you from learning the simplest and most significant lesson of all, which is," wait for it, big moment in the film, "it's not about you. We have the choice in life to either live like everyone normally lives or serve the greater good." That was the moment, and I won't spoil it all, but, you know, it follows the formula. Those words are stirring and emotive, aren't they? Doctor Strange beats the baddie. But, you know, it's a message that's not new to humanity. You just have to look at John Lennon's song, Imagine. And it's the same sentiment. Listen, everybody, if we all thought about each other a bit more, do you know the world would be a better place? And 35 years on, here we are. The song is still sung wistfully. The message is still copied in movies. But wars still rage. Humanity does not change. Now, it might surprise you to hear that in our passage this morning, Jesus tells us almost the same thing. Life is not about us. But whereas philosophy will tell us life is about the greater good, whatever that is, Jesus tells us it's about the glory of God. And that's far more powerful. That's an amazing reason. And it's a far more realistic purpose for our lives. Because whereas humanist philosophy relies on us all being nice together, and that's basically where it breaks down, because we're just not nice to each other. Jesus teaches us to grow his kingdom slowly but powerfully for the glory of God by his strength. And that is not wistful thinking. Because when we look at his kingdom, not 35 years later, but 2,000 years later, his kingdom is still growing. There are more Christians in China than there are people in this country. And that's happened over the last 50 years. Do you get the point? And the heartbeat of his kingdom is seeing the glory of God. It's not about me. And what do I mean about the glory of God? Well, it's a complex expression, but the glory of God can be found in the word wow. That is it. Young people, just think of the term bigged up, and then add to it the meaning of the word heavy, and that's what glory means. Imagine a big responsibility like having to crown the next King of England if ever he gets there. Or lifting the FA Cup for your fans and your team to see. That's wow, that's heavy, that's glory. Think of the best view you've ever seen. Think of the sound of the biggest applause you've ever had. Think of the first cry of a little child. That is wow. That is glory. And when you think about it, when you break glory down, when you break wow down, it's directed at God. It's a weight of the realization that you are tiny and God is big and that it's not about you. That is glory. So as the disciples come down from a mountain where they've seen the glory of Jesus, the future glory of Jesus in all his shining brilliance, Jesus now teaches them about his glory when the rubber hits the road. It's not about me. The highest person for anyone in this life is to make people go, wow, heavy, whoa, awesome, not at me, but at God. So what happens next after Jesus comes down from the mountain? What's the implication of his glory? Well, in a fairy tale, or if we were talking about military leaders, this is the point where Jesus might declare his hand, gather together a bunch of followers and an army and some political alliances, and set out to march to Jerusalem and depose the Romans. That's how professionals did it. Alexander the Great, Augustus Caesar, Xerxes the Persians. They all had a moment when greatness was handed to them on a plate, and they took it. And history tells the rest. And you have to wonder, well, look, with Jesus, you know, you can't get more glorifying than standing on a mountain and revealing your future shining, brilliant glory to the world. So what's Jesus going to do? This is his moment. Well, we've already heard in the reading. It seems that Jesus does nothing with his moment. He comes down the mountain and gets on with life. It's a bit of an anticlimax. And you're left wondering, what is the point of him revealing his glory to the disciples in the first place? Why has he been given a moment and then he doesn't take it? The mountaintop reveal was so significant. You might as well have put a purple robe around Jesus, a crown on his head, and proclaimed him king of the world. But that's not what happens. Jesus comes down the mountain alone with his three disciples, like a normal bloke, and then bang, he's in the thick of it. What is going on here? Well, in our passage, Jesus is simply teaching us three things about the glory of God in this world today. And the first thing he says is God's glory The first thing he says, God's glory is not independence, it's dependence. God's glory is not independence, it's dependence. Look at verse 37 with me, if you will. The next day, when they came down from the mountain, a large crowd met him, A man in the crowd called out, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he's my only child." A spirit seizes him and he suddenly screams. It throws him into convulsions so that he foams at the mouth. It scarcely ever leaves him and is destroying him. "I begged your disciples to drive it out, but they could not." Luke paints the chaos well. A large crowd meets Jesus as he's coming down from the mountain, and the contrast between what we saw last week on the mountain and here cannot be more stark. Mark's gospel tells us that the man who cried out to Jesus had gone to the disciples left behind after Jesus went up the mountain, and he'd begged them to cast out the evil spirit from the boy, but the disciples left behind couldn't do it. And then Mark adds to this picture that they then got into an argument with the religious teachers of the law who were there as well. So there's this chaotic scene, and Jesus walks into the middle of it. The teachers of the law, the disciples, the crowd, the man, the boy. And just like the man had begged the disciples, he shouts above everybody else, clamoring for Jesus' attention, for Jesus just to heal his little boy. And then Jesus speaks. He rebukes the crowds. He rebukes his disciples. And he heals the boy. God's glory is revealed. Jesus' peace and order reign over the muck of the chaos of the situation. And he says this in verse 41. "You unbelieving and perverse generation, how long shall I stay with you and put up with you? Bring your son here." Even while the boy was coming, the demon threw him to the ground in a convulsion. But Jesus rebuked the impure spirit, healed the boy, and gave him back to his father. And they were all amazed at the greatness of God. Why couldn't the disciples heal the boy? Again, we have to go to Matthew and Mark for a bit more detail. Mark tells us that Mark tells us that Jesus rebukes his disciples for prayerlessness, and Matthew tells us he rebukes his disciples for faithlessness. And when you put those two together, you get the explanation. The picture you get is of a bunch of disciples who had previously been given God's power to cast out demons. That was only 8 days before this event. But now they've moved on from trust in God to trusting in the fact that they've done this before. In other words, they've come to have more faith in themselves and their own abilities than the God who's given it. They've cast out demons before, so they were sure they could do it again. And therefore, that's probably why they didn't pray. Can you see the progression? And here's the point. God's kingdom glory is revealed through humble dependence on God's kingship. The enemies of this world, the flesh, the devil, will only be overcome by seeking God's glory through faithful dependence on him. And that is really easy to forget. The devil is keen to undermine our dependence on God because that leads to ineffectiveness as a church. A church like ours can easily get proud of a new building, of facilities, of the whole church ministry, of the numbers. And the devil rejoices in every proud moment of our hearts. Because as we move away from depending on God's power to work through us, we stop praying. We stop giving. We stop serving. We stop trusting. And the momentum that is built on God's power and God's strength is broken. And you know, the only antidote is to keep preaching the glory of God's purpose for us. In 1646, I know it's a long time back, but I love the Puritans, forgive me. I'll try and wheel them out whenever I can. But in 1646, a bunch of Puritans, British Christians, they just laid out the teachings of the Bible in a series of questions and answers that is now known as the Westminster Shorter Catechism. I won't bore you with technical names. And the very first question it asks is this: what is the chief end of man? In other words, what's the greatest purpose? And they asked that at the first because they knew it was the most important thing to get in our heads. What's our goal? What's our purpose? What's our reason for being here? And their answer is this. This is what they wrote hundreds of years ago, 300 years ago almost. "The chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. In other words, it's not about us. Instead, our highest purpose is to stick close to God and seek to point to his work in our lives, through our words, through our faith. Our highest point, and this is the absolute high point of our very existence, is when people look at us and go, wow, at God. It might be the way we talk, the way we listen to people, the way we share, the way we do church, what we look at on our phones and our computers and our tablets, what we read, what we buy, what we think, how we act, what we wear. They all have something to say about our dependence on God to save us and bring us into his glory and to grow his kingdom. And the high point of our being, as I said, is when someone looks at this revealed glory in us, individually and as a church, and asks the simple question, what is it about you? Because they've seen the glory of God. And they respond with a wow. And it's directed at God. God is glorified. God's glory is revealed in our dependence on him, not independence of him. But the second thing that Jesus teaches his disciples about God's glory is that it's not revealed through arrogance, it's revealed through humility. So the disciples are marveling at all he's doing and they're amazed, and some of them have even seen his glory. And then Jesus repeats a well-known chorus of these last four chapters. Look at verse 44 with me. It says this. And it's like, you know, almost a stuck record by now. Listen carefully to what I am about to tell you. We've heard this message kind of preached over the last 6 months. Listen carefully to what I am about to tell you. Literally, the phrase is, let these words sink into your ears. That's how the Greek goes. In modern language, it's get it into your thick heads. It's an urgent command. They needed to listen to Jesus because they were misunderstanding his purpose in his kingdom. And that's why he repeats his purpose in verse 44. Listen carefully to what I am about to tell you. The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. It's the most important thing they needed to hear. Jesus was telling them that God the Son would be glorified by being killed, and 3 days after, rising from the dead. And yet, how did the disciples get it? Verse 45, they did not understand what this meant. They didn't understand what this meant. It was hidden from them. So they didn't grasp it, and they were afraid to ask about it. It's strange, isn't it, that they don't get it? And Luke's kind of giving us two reasons for that. The first is the disciples' explanation, the disciples' expectation of the Messiah was so far away from what Jesus describes that whatever he says outside that script is not going to make sense to them. A Messiah who dies is just not in their hand. They don't get it. They can't read that kind of script. The other reason is because God has ordained that they wouldn't understand him until the timing was right. And in God's mysterious plan, we can be confident that this is something too big for us to make sense of, but that both reasons are operating at the same time without contradiction. And thank God that after Pentecost, in God's timing, by his grace, by his compassion, by his mercy, at the perfect time, the disciples get it. They put all the pieces together and they get it. And the message of the good news just explodes from Jerusalem to where we are now, 3,000 miles away, 2,000 years later. But if it weren't so tragic, the next couple of verses would be comical, wouldn't they? What do we see? After this stunning reveal, guys, get it into your thick skulls. I'm going to die and 3 days later rise again. Verse 46, an argument started amongst the disciples as to which of them would be the greatest. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, took a little child and had him stand before them. Then he said to them, "Whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me. For it is the one who is least among you all who is greatest." Isn't it tragic? Jesus has just said he's going to die and rise again once more to them. He's kind of banging this home to them. And they just don't get it. And then they start, well, you know, when Jesus gets onto his white horse and rides into Jerusalem majestically, who's going to be the greatest in his kingdom? How many counties are you going to rule over, do you think, Peter? Well, you know, you always get it wrong. Why does Luke put this incident here? That's the big question. I think it builds upon that point, doesn't it? It's not about us. Jesus was not saying that his disciples would find his kingdom through being nice to children. But he was saying that how they related to a child, in other words, the child was a figure of lowliness. Children were genuinely seen and not heard in those days, and not really liked anyway. They were very snotty. How you related to lowliness would be a good marker as to whether you are relating to God the King, Jesus the King, and treating him as your brother and putting his words that you've listened to into action. Whoever welcomes this little child, a symbol of lowliness in my name, welcomes me. Because you're listening to my words and putting them into action. Doesn't it underline the point? Life is not about me. It's not about satisfying our longings, fulfilling our potential, massaging our fragile egos. It's not about control or power. It's not about bringing glory to me. The true glory is revealed in humbly accepting Jesus, in listening to his words, and bringing glory to him. And if you're struggling with the question of whether or not you're a Christian here this morning, then the simple answer to that doubt is to tell Jesus you no longer want your life to be about you. You no longer want your life to be about your efforts to get God's acceptance, about your good works or your trying. Do you see how those things still trying to bring the glory to me? I'm trying to get God to be pleased at me. I'm trying to do the work to get me into heaven. That's not the way, not Jesus's way. Do you know that little child is a great illustration of what we need to have a relationship with God? Jesus calls over the little child. "Bob, come here." And Bob does. "Stand there, Bob, and let me just use you as a quick lesson for my disciples." And Bob stands there. Do you see, the little child trusted Jesus. The little child did what Jesus asked him to do. That little child followed Jesus' commands. And what Jesus commands us to do, what Jesus invites us to do, is trust in him, trust in his work on the cross, trust in his resurrection that declares eternal life for all who believe in him, trust in his glory. And that is all we need to do to see his glory at work in our lives. Will you trust him this morning? Will you talk to him and ask him to forgive you? Forgive you for trying to make it about me, us. And tell him you're sorry for being like the disciples in this story, blind and egocentric. Will you ask him to be king of your life? Will you do that this morning? Perhaps we're already Christians this morning, but it might be that we've lost our perspective. For believers here this morning, perhaps we need to confess to God our need to be like the little child and not like the disciples. Let's trust Jesus to grow his kingdom in us. Let's once more seek the riches of his glory in the way that we humbly listen to his words and put them into action. And that brings us to our final point of this passage. It's simply this: Jesus' glory is not about selfish ambition. It's about God's generosity. It's wonderful, isn't it? It's not about selfish ambition. It's about God's generosity. Look at verse 49 with me. "Master," said John, "we saw someone driving out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he's not one of us." "Do not stop him," Jesus said, "for whoever is not against you is for you." It seemed that during their journeying around 8 days before, as Jesus sent them out, some of the disciples had encountered a freelance exorcist who had apparently not been called in the same way as John and the disciples. And they hadn't been commissioned in the same way by Jesus with specific instructions. So the disciples' reaction was to stop the man because, hey, he wasn't one of them. He wasn't doing it according to the way that they had been told. And they weren't, and he wasn't told by Jesus. He didn't have the correct credentials. The qualifications were wrong. And again, their attitude towards that man reflected the danger of their thinking. So it seems that they were beginning to think that they had the monopoly of God's power. And because they were special disciples, his kingdom could only be shared through them. And Jesus' reply is both a rebuke and a principle. Jesus says, don't stop him and have a generous heart like Jesus. In other words, the man was doing kingdom work and that had to go on in spite of him not having the right qualifications. And the principle here underlines that God's glory is revealed in God's generous ways of working. If God is using the unusual to save the lost, well, let's not quarrel, let's bless the work and praise God in humble recognition that God's kingdom is way bigger than us. And let me just add a caveat to that. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be discerning. Jesus is not saying that all people who claim to be Christians are working in his name. The disciples weren't being discerning here. They were being arrogant, and that's why Jesus is rebuking them. Discernment, on the other hand, is good because it forces us to think carefully about the message we share with this world and about carefully working with others who share the gospel message too, no matter how different their way is. Which means we have to put our prejudices and fears aside. Let me confess now that I have an irrational dislike for mime artists, but give me one that shares the gospel even without words. I know, I have no idea how, but even one who shares the gospel without words, do you know, I have to humbly embrace their gospel work in partnership with us. Isn't it wonderful? The gospel goes to this world in all ways. It's not about me. And that seems to be the point of these passages, isn't it? Jesus' glory is revealed in disciples who are dependent on the Savior. Let's depend on him with joy and thanksgiving that he's given us that opportunity to depend on him. His glory is revealed as we humbly embrace him like little children. If you've not done that yet this morning, then please come and speak to myself or Ian or Pat and Jeff or anyone you've seen this morning who you'd like to talk to. Talk to them and humbly embrace the Savior like that little child did. Jesus' glory is revealed wonderfully in all of us who do his work by his authority. That's a wonderful, wonderful message because it means that you and I can, all of us, share the gospel in our God-given ways for his glory. It's not about us. It's about him. And we can be used by him to share that glorious message with this world that is lost. Let's rejoice in that. Let's thank him for that. Let's go wow at God together for his remarkable ways, his mysterious, mysterious ways, but his ways that are bringing a lost world into a wonderful light of the glory of God.